The market, how it actually works. I sent all of you an email. I assume, did everybody get my email with a correction to another offhanded comment I made in class? I want to encourage you when I say something that you either find especially interesting and I don't give enough support for it, or some statistic that I give which you're skeptical about, to press me on it, to do your own research, to check out my sources, or to ask me for further elaboration. In that particular case, it was easy enough for me to check it out. I have a former student, Mansour Moadel, who's a professor in Michigan. He did his dissertation on the Iranian Revolution and has been doing surveys throughout the Middle East for many years. That's what he does. He does survey research on various kinds of political and social religious attitudes. And I had recalled him saying in some event where we were together that there were more atheists, a higher percentage of the population were atheists in Saudi Arabia than the United States. But when I asked him about it, having been prompted by a student in the class, he said that he didn't think he had said that. What he had said is that there's a higher percentage of people who attend church in the United States than attend mosques in Saudi Arabia and Iran. I stand corrected. It may be true, of course, but we don't have any data to support the claim that there are more atheists in the United States than in Saudi Arabia than the U.S. That wasn't a very important comment for purposes of the main line of argument of the course. I was using that to just emphasize the fact that the United States has this very strong religious culture. We have a very high level of religiosity by any standard, and that was meant to be a kind of little icing on the cake to really drive that point home. But I was wrong on that. So I thank the student who asked for more details. One little correction in the book. The point of this correction will make sense after the Tuesday lecture. But on page 60 in the text, incorrectly makes a point in discussing this thing called the prisoner's dilemma. So don't worry about it. It'll all make sense. I'll go over it in class. But you just might make a note that on page 60, there is this error. Okay, let's begin. In the last session, we explored the question how the market is supposed to work and how the virtues that defenders of the market see being generated by capitalist markets. We looked at a number of aspects of the defense of the market, the virtues that markets are supposed to realize. And I think these can be summarized basically under four very general headings. First, in terms of the moral arguments for the market, markets are an expression of the value of individual freedom. I suppose more than anything else, defenders of the market on moral grounds really emphasize this point. Freedom is certainly a very deeply held value among Americans. It's a pretty deeply held value among most people in the world, even if they don't necessarily use the word. But most people would rather live in a world in which they're not controlled by other people, where they control their own destinies. Self-control, self-determination, self-governance, these are all values which I think are very, very broadly held, but certainly extremely strongly held in the United States. And markets can legitimately be viewed as a institution that embodies that value. Because after all, in a market, people make agreements voluntarily. In the simplest case, they make an exchange of something, money for a product, let's say. The exchanges are voluntary. You're not forced to do it. You do it because you choose to do it. And that is a key aspect of freedom. That's the first defense of the market. Why should we have markets? Because it embodies this moral value. Secondly, markets solve a really tricky problem. How do you coordinate millions of people in a complex society, and now in a complex global society? How can you possibly coordinate all of their activities so the activities kind of fit together in a coherent way? Well, markets accomplish this. For all of the flaws that I will point to in markets, all of the ways in which they're inefficient, and indeed all of the ways in which they may indeed cause very deep harms in people's lives. In spite of all that, it is absolutely true that markets accomplish a feat of global coordination that when you really put your mind around it just seems almost impossible. How could this possibly take place? How could you coordinate your decision to want to build something in Madison with the decision of a peasant in some far distant place to grow something? That's a really hard problem, and markets do a very good job overall in solving that coordination problem. And it's done through this particular set of mechanisms, which we very briefly touched on, the mechanisms of supply and demand and price. The price of things interacting with this mysterious process of supply and demand generates coordination between what you want and what other people do. Just really think about that. What you want, you get other people to do things for you by buying things and sending signals and creating this equilibrium, as it's referred to, between supply and demand. Really an extraordinary accomplishment. And that is a virtue of the market. Now, I'm stressing this. If I was a person who pounded on podiums, I'd pound on the podium. I'm stressing these virtues because I want you to understand this really hard idea that something can have virtues and still have very serious negative effects as well. People don't like this. This is a little bit of a digression. People don't like to think that the things which they value most can also be extremely harmful. In politics, this is chronically a problem. People want simple solutions where there are no downsides. Politicians always promise everything, right? That's a standard problem in elections. They promise everything and they don't tell you about all the downsides of what they're promising. We're facing that problem in an incredibly intense way in this election cycle. Well, I want to emphasize the virtues of markets precisely because I'm very critical of markets, as opposed to ignore the virtues and just focus on the criticisms. These are virtues. And it means if you're going to criticize market institutions, and in particular capitalist markets, if you're going to criticize them, you have to worry about whether your criticisms will undermine the virtues. What you want, if you want to change things, is to somehow or other, and this may be magic, it may not be possible, what you'd really like to do is to retain the virtues and correct the harms. But that's the ideal. If you see something as having all these positive effects and yet it causes harms in human life, you'd like to figure out a way, how could we neutralize the harms and maintain the virtues? Well, that turns out to be a really hard problem. And anybody who thinks it's simple, and any politician who thinks it's simple, is just being simple-minded. These are hard problems, not easy problems. And because I am a pretty sharp critic of these institutions, I think it's important for me to emphasize the virtues, not just the things I find wrong. That might seem a little ironic. You know, if I'm a critic, I should only emphasize the nastiness. Well, I think that's not the right way to approach it. If you're a critic, you should appreciate the virtues, understand how they work, and then in that context, identify the harms as a basis then for thinking through the problem, how do we improve? Okay, that's my little homily on virtues and harms. Back to the list of virtues. The third virtue, efficiency. This is a standard argument in defense of the markets, that markets produce efficient outcomes, which mostly, when people talk about the efficiency of outcomes, they're meaning what we call allocative efficiency. That is, The distribution of things is efficient because you can't redistribute anything without making somebody worse off. Remember this peculiar expression, Pareto optimality. A Pareto optimality is the technical term that economists use to describe a distribution of anything that has that property. Just to remind you again, if you distribute apples and oranges in this class and you allow everybody to switch around and trade their apples and oranges until no one wants to make a trade, everybody is either happy with what they want, what they have, or they can't find anybody to trade, that at that moment you can say nobody could be made better off in the classroom without somebody being made worse off. And that is one meaning of efficiency. That's an efficient distribution in this very special sense, because it would certainly be inefficient if somebody could be made better without anybody being made worse off. And if everybody's allowed to trade, you eventually reach a point where that's not true. So markets accomplish that kind of allocative efficiency. And finally, and I think this is actually a more interesting and important argument than the simple allocative efficiency. Finally, markets create strong incentives for risk-taking and innovation. And this is at the core of economic development and growth. Markets create incentives for risk-taking in the following very specific sense. In a market, if you take a risk and you get a big payoff from it, you reap the benefits. And that creates an incentive to take risks. I mean, there wouldn't be an incentive to innovate under this way of thinking about innovation if whenever you innovated, everybody else got the benefits and not you. Now, that turns out, just to let you know some things we'll be talking about later, that turns out actually not to be so much the case. A lot of the innovations that we think of as coming out of the last 50 years of economic development, many of the innovations occur in research labs. And in most research labs, the people actually making the innovations don't get a big payoff from the innovations. In universities, mostly when people invent things and discover things, they get glory, they get fame for having done so, but they don't get rich off of it. And so it's not so simple to say that you wouldn't get innovation without markets, because people are motivated to innovate for all sorts of reasons aside from just purely personal gain. But putting that aside, it nevertheless is the case that markets have this character of stimulating people to innovate, of providing incentives, and providing payoffs. So those are four virtues of markets. I think this is a pretty comprehensive list. There may be other things that people sometimes say as to why capitalist markets are a good thing. Mostly they would be variations on these four themes. So that's what's good about markets. That's how markets are defended. Now let's turn to the actual practice of real markets in the real world. Let me tell you how this discussion is going to proceed. In the rest of this lecture and the lecture on Tuesday, I'm going to talk about general categories of problems. We're going to explore 6 or 7 different ways in which markets generate harms, where markets are inefficient, or where markets simply impose harms on people. We're going to look at a bunch of different ways. But I'll be discussing these mostly at a theoretical level. I'll be explaining the reasons, the mechanisms, the processes by which these harms are generated. In the next group of lectures, the next 5 or 6 lectures, we're going to take these ideas and then apply them to very specific practical problems. We'll look at the environment, we'll look at healthcare, look at public transportation, and a few other things. We'll look at a variety of aspects of life that matter to people and see how well markets do with respect to them. That's where I'll be presenting lots of data, lots of concrete empirical information about how American institutions actually work, but using the tools that we're developing in this lecture and the next. So these two lectures will be more abstract. There'll be more about the core ideas that we need in order to analyze particular institutions. In the next couple of weeks, we'll be looking at very specific case studies. Okay, so how do markets actually fare? First, let's look at markets and freedom. Markets and this core value which defenders of the markets focus on. In order to understand how markets bear on the question of freedom, it's crucial to really have firmly in mind this distinction between negative freedom and positive freedom. Now, both of these are valuable. I'm a defender of negative freedom, but I'm also a defender of positive freedom. And I think for most people, in their gut intuition about what it means to be a free person, they include aspects of both. That is, most people, when they, in answer to the question, why is it a good thing to live in a society that values freedom, mostly they don't simply say, because I don't want anybody telling me what to do. They say, it's because I want to be able to decide myself what to do. Right? So the idea of deciding for yourself what to do, you decide what your life plans are. You decide what careers you want to do. You decide how you want to live your life. That's the positive aspect. It's you deciding it. The negative aspect is nobody else telling you what to do. Now, the positive aspect has this very special problem to it, that your ability to decide what to do doesn't amount to much if you have no resources, because you can't actually execute your plans, your purposes, your goals, if you are, for one reason or another, deprived of resources. To actually act in the world, to make choices and do things, you have to have a capacity to act. And you're less free in this positive sense if you don't have access to resources. It's one of the reasons why, for example, many people think it's a good thing to have free public education. Because free public education is a way to give everybody some basic resources needed to be able to act in the world, to be able to make choices, to be able to be self-determining in their own life plans. That's one of the reasons. It's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons why people think, yes, everybody should have equal access to education, that it's a bad idea to have education made only available to a few, because that would not just be unfair in the sense of some people would end up wealthier than others, but it would be unfair in the sense that some people would be deprived of what could be called real freedom, or what we're calling here positive freedom. So I think it's important to really think through this issue, to mull it over. If you believe in positive freedom, if you think that's actually valuable, and when you say freedom and justice for all, you know, the various kinds of slogans we have, what we mean by the freedom in that expression is self-determination, which means the actual ability to determine what you do, not just the phony ability, the symbolic ability, the thin ability, the real ability to act in the world. So there are these two aspects of freedom. Markets particularly do a good job around negative freedom. It's one of the reasons why, for example, some people were so upset about the Obama health plan requiring people to purchase health insurance, because it seemed to be a violation of this core idea of a free market. That is, you're free to buy, but you're free not to buy. Nobody should tell you what to buy. There's this irony that if it was a universal health care system where you just had health insurance provided by the government, as we have for the elderly, then that wouldn't be an issue, because you're not being forced to buy anything. You're just being given it and paying for it through taxes. It might seem like a pretty thin distinction between being forced to pay taxes to get a universal health insurance versus being forced to buy it on a market. But I think that distinction is why some people were upset at that particular provision. We'll talk about healthcare later in more detail. So markets are pretty good on negative freedom. I think they do a pretty poor job on positive freedom. That is, the nature of markets ensures that some people will have huge levels of self-determination and positive freedom, and other people will have gigantic obstacles to overcome in order to be able to determine the course of their own life. We do not have real freedom for all. We have real negative freedom for all, but not real positive freedom. So what are the conclusions then around this first value? First, as I said, the market does a pretty good job in at least partially realizing the value of negative freedom. No one directly forces you to buy anything. But I would want to, even with respect to negative freedom, emphasize that it's not exactly true that the market perfectly embodies the ideal of negative freedom. Partially, this depends upon exactly what you mean by being forced to do something. Now, it's true in markets, nobody holds a gun to your head and literally forces you. That's not the way markets function. But there are ways in which there are quite coercive forms of constraint imposed on people besides the direct threat of physical violence that in a practical way get very close to forcing people to engage in certain kinds of market activities. Coercion can be generated by the nature of the alternatives you face in making your choices. That can, one can, I think, legitimately regard it as coercive if the choices you face are so limited that you basically have to engage in a particular kind of market activity. So let me be less vague and abstract about this. If you do not own wealth, in order to eat, you have to sell your labor for a wage to an employer. And once at work, you have to do what you are told or you're fired. For most workers, the workplace is a site of domination, of unfreedom, of coercion. For most people in their workplaces, they are being dominated by others, being told what to do. They do not have choice to say no. Negative freedom is the freedom to say no. And for most workers employed in most organizations, they do not have the power to say no. Now, of course, this domination is softened by the fact that workers can quit their jobs. And that is a absolutely fundamental distinction between being employed in a capitalist labor market and being a slave. Workers and slaves both are told to follow orders, to do what they're told, but the worker has one key form of freedom that the slave doesn't have. They can quit their job. But since most people have no realistic alternative but to then seek another job, you are still forced in a way, and I think this is a reasonable way of thinking about it, you're still forced to seek another job, another employment, so long as you live in a purely market economy. Now, this is, of course, one of the reasons why even in the United States, we are not in a purely market economy. We have unemployment insurance. We have welfare redistribution. We have all sorts of programs that make it a little bit easier for somebody who loses a job to not simply take whatever the next available job might be. For most people, the only realistic alternative to one job is another one where they're still controlled by managers and employers. The freedom to quit a job doesn't really mean, for most people, in practice, the freedom to avoid domination within work. Now, I think that's a violation of negative freedom. Some people would say, no, you know, the fact that you can quit is sufficient to say that you're free. You're free of domination because you can always say no, you can quit. I think that's a very thin view of even negative freedom. It's a thin view of negative freedom because most people do not have the option in their lives to live their lives autonomously. I said at the very beginning of the class and introducing myself to you that I'm in this unbelievably privileged position because I do live such a life. I mean, it's literally the case that no one ever tells me what to do. I have absolute control over everything I do. You know, that's a slight exaggeration by one iota, but it's a pretty good approximation. That's an incredibly privileged position. And with my colleagues, we jointly decide on all of the collective things that need to be done in the sociology department. Whenever there's an issue about changing the rules, about curriculum change, about hiring new people, all of these things we make as a joint collective decision. So I either have individual self-determination, I autonomously decide what to do, or I have collective self-determination. We call that democracy. I can decide what to do with my colleagues. Well, that's an incredibly rare condition to live in. And that, I think, implies that market economies, as such, do not really fully embody negative freedom, although they do a pretty good job on negative freedom. With respect to positive freedom, however, I think the freedom-depriving character of private property is very clear. Of course, you can cite many wonderful rags-to-riches stories that show how somebody arrives in the United States with not a penny in their pocket and they end up by pluck and other devices becoming rich. And many people then use the fact that some people who start with nothing can nevertheless, in spite of that, put their life plans into effect as an argument that markets do not deprive people of positive freedom. I think this is basically the equivalent of observing that because some people manage to escape from prison, which certainly is true, people do escape from prison, that prisons do not restrict people's freedom. Prisons massively restrict freedom, and yet people can escape from prison. And it's undoubtedly the case that the prisoners who escape from prison may be the most able, you know, maybe the cleverest and most ingenious and craftiest prisoners with the most initiative that escape from prison. But you would not want to conclude from the fact that a clever person can escape from prison that prisons don't deny people freedom. And that's, I think, the point to really think about with respect to this notion of positive freedom. Free markets inherently generate very large disparities in resources available to people. If everyone started out in the same position, with the same assets, and these differences were just the result of their efforts and choice, then we might reasonably say this does not contradict positive freedom. That is, if all the inequalities we observe were simply the result of efforts and choice by people, then it would not contradict positive freedom. But in fact, most people who accumulate great wealth started with at least considerable wealth. And I think it's reasonably to say that they have greater freedom, not just more stuff, than somebody who's born poor. The child in a poor family has less freedom than the child in a rich family, not just less stuff. And that's the sense in which markets contradict one of the core values which markets are supposed to embody, the value of freedom. In response to this, defenders of the markets have generally rejected the notion of positive freedom altogether. The general way that libertarians who defend the market on this moral ground of freedom, the general strategy is to try to strip the concept of freedom from this positive notion, to give a very reduced notion of freedom as being the core value. that's a perfectly legitimate intellectual move. I mean, that's a way you can continue to defend something. I don't think it corresponds to most people's gut intuitions about why they care about freedom. Because I think for most people, this positive idea, which is a kind of exuberant notion of flourishing by putting your life purposes into place, I think that positive idea is part of how most people actually come to value this thing which we call freedom. Okay, that's all that I have to say about these moral issues. Is there anyone who wants to respond or have any thoughts on this? This is, you know, these are controversial and important questions. Yeah. Stock markets are a very specialized form of taking risks. It's not, I think, the most interesting one from the point of view of understanding how a market economy and how a capitalist economy grows. Because after all, when you buy stocks in a stock market, mostly what you're doing is buying stocks that other people already own. And you're buying them because you think they're going to increase in value or because you want a piece of the action of some corporation and you'll get dividends. It's an investment. And there is risk involved, and you do get a return on it. But I think the more interesting kind of risk-taking has to do with starting up a new company, with inventing new things, with figuring out better ways of producing. One way to think about it is this. If you think there's a better way, a cheaper way you can produce something and devote a lot of resources, research and development, time and effort to developing these new technologies, it turns out that most efforts to do that fail. So most people who try to invent something to improve how you produce waste their time. They try to do it, spend a lot of time, they don't get any return. So occasionally somebody gets a big return. Most people fail at that. And that's why it's risk-taking to try to invent something. So that's the part of the incentive structure that I think has the most dynamic quality. When people are investing in already established companies through secondary stock markets and the like, I mean, that is also risk-taking, but I don't think it's the key to the issue. Yeah. Yeah, no, these are general abstract ideas. These are the values that we care about, and you can apply these values to any context. So you could ask of a family. You know, we observe many different kinds of families. You all came from families, and you had different sorts of families. Well, some families allocate lots of resources to their kids, so their kids can develop their own life plans and put them into effect. So you could say, in other families, kids are under very tight control and the parents are telling them what to do, right? So you could sort of see families as varying in terms of positive and negative freedom. Whole societies can vary. Given firms could vary. So these are general values. They don't just apply to the market. Yeah. So the question was that positive freedom is just a relatively recent problem, because if you go back a generation, it was much easier for somebody who didn't have resources to still figure out a way to get a good job and accumulate enough resources to put their life plans into effect. The way I think you're tapping into something real. The way I would describe it is that it was always the case that there are these two sides to freedom, positive and negative. It was always the case that markets do a better job on negative freedom than positive freedom, but the situation has gotten worse. That in recent decades, because of increasing inequality and because of increasing barriers of various sorts, if you don't have resources, you're in a much worse position now than you would have been 30 years ago in terms of being able to overcome those obstacles. And there are some countries in the world where today positive freedom is much more equally distributed in the population than here, because there's much more universal provision of those resources. There are places where university education is free for everybody, no tuition at all, where all sorts of other facilities say everybody should have the same basic resources so that everybody can put their life plans into place. Now, there's no place that has full positive freedom for everyone, but countries do vary in how much positive freedom is restricted or available to everyone. Any other comments on this theme, and then we'll move on. Yeah. So the question was that it may be true that workers can quit, but that they have relatively limited ability to escape from these restrictions on negative freedom, because their next job they'll also be dominated. The question is whether this is just inevitable, that it's sort of part of human nature rather than something that we could imagine could be changed. Well, we could easily imagine some things that would at least reduce the problem. We could, for example, imagine that even in a capitalist economy, workers would elect what in some places are called works councils, councils of employees. This is separate from unions, that workers in a workplace would elect a governing council, and that governing council would be responsible for ensuring all sorts of choice, of ability of workers to actually shape their work environment. So you could imagine a workplace in which domination was significantly reduced. And of course, we can imagine something even more radical. We could imagine worker cooperatives, that is, firms in a market that are owned by the workers themselves, where they collectively decide what to do and how to do it. Well, that would be a workplace that would not deny people negative freedom. They would be participating in the collective running of the firm. Now, you might say it would be a bad idea because it wouldn't work very well. That's another question. That would be because of the trade-off, possibly, between efficiency and freedom. But other alternatives are possible. Yeah, one more question, then we'll move on. Yeah. Yeah. No. No, you can have both or neither. You could have slaves have neither. They're low on both. In a worker cooperative, you have both. You can have all combinations. It's probably not the case that you could have no negative freedom and a lot of positive freedom. That is, no negative freedom means you're constantly being told what to do by somebody else. So it's hard to see how you could have positive freedom, an ability to put your life plans into effect, if you lack negative freedom. Somebody's holding a gun to your head telling you what to do. But you could be free on both dimensions, or just free on one. And one last, yeah.
Okay, so if the government would increase regulations to give you more positive freedom, then would you still not be free because you don't become dependent on the government?
We're going to discuss this idea of what it means to be dependent or independent. In due course. The question was, if the government created regulations that gave you more positive freedom? Would this make you dependent? Well, it makes you interdependent. That is, you're more connected to the public sphere and how it provides supports. But do we really want to say that if in Wisconsin we decided to make university tuition free because we thought this would create greater access for everybody, and that we're going to pay for this by higher taxes to provide this resource to everybody, does that really make students more dependent on the government? Well, it makes you more dependent on the fact that you live in Wisconsin as opposed to a state where you don't, because if you went somewhere else, you wouldn't get this benefit. But it really enhances the autonomy of people to guide their lives as they wish, rather than making them more constrained, dependent on somebody else telling them what to do. So if dependence means somebody else is telling you what to do, you're less dependent. If dependence means that your flourishing depends upon being in a place that provides those resources, then you are dependent. So the word dependency has these different faces to it. It's not a simple issue. Okay, let's move on now to the first of what will be, forget how many, I think there's six. Let me see. Just so we know, you know where we're going. We have a total of five different sources of market inefficiency. So now we're going to leave the freedom issue behind. We're now going to talk about the ways in which markets might end up actually being pretty inefficient. The first item. This is really getting at the guts of the matter. The first item, information failure and consumer vulnerability. Capitalist firms have very strong incentives in hiding information from consumers, in raising the costs of getting adequate information. The allocative efficiency of markets, that is this Pareto optimality story, you know, which we were talking about. Allocative efficiency depends upon the people trading in markets having good information. But often this is just completely impossible. Because of this, we have lots of laws that regulate markets and on all sorts of things. We have laws that prevent firms from false advertising. We don't have laws that prevent them from exaggerated and distorted advertising or manipulative advertising, but they can't. You can sue a company for having an outright lie in an ad. They can't tell you that a product has certain specific properties when it doesn't. But there are many other issues as well. For example, we require firms to provide certain kinds of information to consumers, for example, food labeling, which those firms would not provide. They would not do it unless they were forced to. In a perfectly free market, we would not have food nutrition labeling. If it was up to firms, they wouldn't do it. Laws require label on nutrition on food violate the free market. And that's why firms always oppose laws that require them to label things. In Wisconsin, there's been a big battle over whether milk producers should or should not be required to label milk as having growth hormone in it. Now, there's all sorts of issues around in the science about this, whether it matters or not. But nevertheless, there are plenty of consumers who would like to know, does the milk have growth hormone in it? Was it produced in cows that were given growth hormones? And the dairy industry fought it. They did not want to have that label on food. Even things as simple as the calorie content or the saturated fat content, the food industry objected to being forced to label it. Well, you can see how this matters for the efficiency of the market. The efficiency of the market depends upon people knowing what they're buying and being able to make judgments as to whether to buy X or Y. Firms have incentives to prevent that kind of information. So imagine how this would work in a perfectly free market. So here's a scenario, how you would have these kinds of issues dealt with in a perfectly free market. Firms could make whatever claims they liked about their products. If consumers felt it was valuable for them to know the truth, then there would be a market in information. There'd be a way for them to buy information about products. You would have firms that would specialize in testing and evaluating the qualities of products, and you could then buy that service, which would enable you, if you cared about the information, to get it. Of course, in a free market, firms wouldn't want to distort information too much because that might lead them to lose customers. Reputations do matter. And consumers who were harmed by products because they bought them and the products had faulty information, they could always take the firms to court. You could sue companies. Well, is that the kind of world you'd prefer to live in? Would that actually create a more efficient way of people satisfying their needs in a market? To have everything commercialized, including the information about the things you consume. And to have the only redress not being government regulation of product safety and product quality and product information, but whenever something went wrong, all you could do would be to sue in court. Well, this seems to me like a pretty chaotic situation, and one that would actually provide much weaker protection for consumers and create, therefore, massive inefficiencies. People would buy things and spend their resources in ways that don't satisfy their needs. That's inefficient. It's inefficient if you buy something thinking it's going to be healthy and it ends up being unhealthy. If you buy something that you think is going to work and it doesn't work, that's an inefficiency in the market that's built around this problem of information. And the key issue here, the thing to keep in mind, is that sellers have an incentive to distort information. We, of course, have folk sayings, buyers beware, right? That's a folk saying, buyer beware. It means that you should always be skeptical about what you're told when you're buying something. Well, that's a truth about markets, but it's a truth that has very big implications for this general idea that markets are efficient. This is why we need regulations. Let me give you another just example about inefficiency that's caused by the way in which markets actually operate that bear on this question of information. This is a famous case from the 1960s, but around the Ford Pinto. I discussed this a little bit in the chapter in the book. But just so that you don't think this is something that is just ancient history, similar cases happen all the time. In the 1990s, there was a problem of SUVs rolling over, that their balance wasn't well adapted for the ordinary use that people put these vehicles to. So they would have a tendency to roll over. And it was a similar story. So here's basically what happened. The problem was that in the initial design of the Ford Pinto, there was a faulty placement of gas tanks, which created an unfortunate tendency for the cars to explode in some kinds of rear-end collisions. And not just in horrendous collisions. If you got hit in just the wrong way from behind, your gas tank would explode. The cost of the change, as estimated by the engineers at Ford Motor Company, would be approximately $11 a car. That's what it would have taken to fix the problem. Ford made the following calculation. Even if they take into account the costs of settling lawsuits, and they figured that on average there'd be 180 deaths a year, and this is the result of documents, internal documents within Ford Motor Company. This isn't just speculation by critics. These are the documents inside as they made these calculations. There's 180 deaths a year due to exploding Pintos. That's going to cost us a lot of money in terms of settlements and court cases. On the other hand, to retrofit all the cars that have been sold by bringing them in, making the $11 change, that's probably about $70 change in current dollars. Making the change and dealing with all the paperwork with that, well, they figured that's going to actually cost more than letting 180 people die a year and settling in court. So they figured it was more profitable not to do the repair and therefore to deny that there's a problem. So Ford Motor Company had an advertising campaign and a PR campaign that denied that there was this problem. They hid information. They delayed in court. They tried to overwhelm plaintiffs with high-priced lawyers that would argue that all of this was the result of reckless driving on the part of the accident victims. And they used their economic and political power first to block legislation and then to block effective implementation of stricter safety regulations. So they used the power they had by virtue of being a large corporation to block the legislation that would have improved the safety regulations. The legislation to require safety regulations were delayed from 1961 to 1966. And because of court cases and other procedural issues, the actual effective implementation of the regulations was delayed until 1977. And even though all of those delays required Ford Motor Company spending quite a lot of money on lawyers, on lobbyists, and on other mechanisms, in spite of that, that was the most profitable thing for Ford Motor Company to do. Hundreds of lives were lost as a result. And you can tell this kind of story over and over. Now, this is a chronic feature of a market economy because of the incentives that producers have to hide information that would be adverse to their interests. And this, of course, erodes this idea of consumer sovereignty, that it's really consumers that are driving the whole system as opposed to the power of the producers. Second source of market inefficiency. We've already touched on this in the Ford example. Monopoly power. Allocative efficiency depends upon what's called perfect competition. But American capitalism is dominated by giant corporations, and giant corporations exert real power in markets over both other firms and over individuals. What's power? This is a concept that we'll be encountering lots during the semester. What do we mean by power? Power, I would argue, there are many definitions of power. Those of you who are going to take sociology or political science courses, or philosophy courses for that matter, that deal with political questions, you're going to encounter lots of discussions of power over the years. And some of these discussions will be completely impenetrable. There are discussions of power that I find difficult to understand what's being talked about. I'll give you a very straightforward idea of power, concept of power, that's, I think, sufficient for our purposes. Power is the ability to get your way even over the objections of others. It's your ability to oppose your will on others. You have power over other people if you can get them to do things against their will. Some people want to say that if you can persuade people to do things, that also is power. Well, that's a little trickier. If you persuade people to do things by giving them good reasons and they change their minds, I am hesitant to say that it means that you have power over them. But there are cases where your ability to manipulate how people think may in the end mean that you're getting them to do things that are no longer against their will because you've changed their will, but you've done so by manipulating their will rather than just by giving them persuasive arguments. That's why the concept of power gets complicated, gets fuzzy because of these kinds of things. Let's keep it simple. If I can get you to do things against your will, I have power over you. And in a limited way, I do. I imagine that taking the exams is not something that you would freely do if given the choice. You know, if you could press a button and not have to take the exam and have it not have any consequences, many of you would push that button. You can't push the button because there would be consequences, and the fact that I get to impose the consequences is the way in which I get you to do things, at least some of you to do things. I know many of you will take the exam out of your love of knowledge and your wanting the feedback, but nevertheless, it does constitute a power relationship. Now, if I came to class and said to you, I have an old laptop which I no longer need, does anybody want to buy it for $200? And somebody said yes, that would not reflect power. That is, it's not because I have any power over you that you're buying it. It's because it would satisfy some need and it would seem like a bargain. That's the way most people think markets work, that markets are the enemy of power, not the embodiment of power. Because in markets, what the sellers do is just offer things up for sale, and people then freely decide whether or not they're going to buy them. The problem is that that's not actually how markets work. Markets don't work in the way that I just described my bringing a laptop to sell in the class. It's an inherent feature of market dynamics that winners in competition will become larger and larger and tend to have concentrated wealth and power. And at some point, they can actually exert real power inside of the market over other people. Microsoft, Walmart, British Petroleum, Boeing, many other corporations don't just make things and sell them on the market. They shape the market through their exercise of power. A large corporation is not like a corner grocery store that just has products on the shelf and you come in and decide what you want. It's not just that, but bigger. It has the ability to make strategic choices that massively constrain the actions of other people and communities. Walmart, for example, forces its suppliers to squeeze workers to ruthlessly cut costs. It's so big that the suppliers cannot say, no, I'm not going to treat my workers that way. They risk going out of business if they don't comply with the demands of Walmart, and the demands are to continually cut costs. Microsoft bundles various kinds of software together in packages and forces people to buy things they don't want to buy. It forces them because they don't really have much alternative because of the dominance of Microsoft within the market. Gigantic financial institutions can engage in all sorts of risky financial dealings that jeopardize the livelihoods of tens of millions of people, which those people did not choose. It imposes their will on them in the sense of imposing consequences on their lives without them agreeing to it. And this is the result of the power they have. In the financial crisis, when certain banks were described as too big to fail, they were so huge that if they failed, they would bring catastrophe down on everybody. They were too big to fail. That means that they had power. They had power to take risks which other people would have to pay for, not them. That's what too big to fail means. So in all these ways and many others, the concentrations of power that get generated by the market itself violate the central mechanism that makes markets efficient, namely perfect competition. And the only way you can get around that is by interfering with the way the market works. Now, you might be doing so in the name of trying to make the market behave more like a market, but still you are intervening, you are interfering, you're imposing rules and regulations that prevent the actors in the market doing just what they want. That's the second source of inefficiency, concentrated economic power. Now we get to a really big one. This is crucial. The issue of public goods, which we'll probably not get to until Tuesday, these are really getting to the very heart of the problem, negative externalities. So you can underline that concept, put a few stars by it. I can guarantee you 100% that you'll be asked about negative externalities on the exam. Guarantee. So you really should understand, get to understand this concept. Negative externality. This is a classic example of the failure of the price mechanism to generate optimal allocations. Let me give you the definition first. The definition of a negative externality is a negative side effect of an activity that affects other people. Pollution is the simplest example. It's the, when you talk about negative externalities in a market economy, pollution is the example that's often given. You have in Wisconsin paper factories which for decades dumped toxic waste into public waterways and created toxic environments downstream. That's a negative externality. The paper company didn't dump the toxic waste into the water in order to poison people downstream. That wasn't part of their purpose. It was just a convenient way of getting rid of the toxic waste. And that's the chronic thing that happens with pollution. Producers have to deal with this waste somehow or other. They'll deal with it in the cheapest way possible. That's the profit-maximizing thing to do. If you want to maximize your profit and you can get rid of wastes in a very expensive way that protects the environment and imposes no harms on others, or you can get away with just dumping it into the environment at almost no cost, the latter will be the way the market tells you to do it. The market will say, dump it, because that will reduce your costs and that will make you more competitive. Market efficiency depends on the prices reflecting the true costs of producing things. That's why you get efficiency, is because you sell something at a price that reflects what it costs to produce it. But firms often systematically displace costs and risks onto others so that they can sell things effectively below cost. So that's really how you should think about this. If I am a producer and I can dump my waste in the environment and impose costs on you because you have to deal with the negative effects, I don't have to pay for that. You pay for that. But it is still part of the cost of producing. You know, it's still part of what it costs in terms of all the resources and inputs. It's still part of what it costs to produce something. The toxic waste from the paper factory is part of the cost of producing paper. But if I can get you to pay for it, then I can sell my paper at a lower price and I can have a competitive advantage. Selling it at a lower price in this case means actually selling it below cost. I should have negative profits, but I don't. I find it very profitable. But the only reason it's profitable is because I've imposed costs on other people. When capitalist firms do this, this doesn't mean that the particular people, the particular owners of those firms are evil people. The problem is not mainly a failure of integrity, although sometimes that's in play as well. The problem lies in the ways in which our institutions make it rational and profit-maximizing for people to behave this way. In the absence of environmental regulation that says you cannot impose costs on other people in this way, and that's a strong regulation. It says it will be illegal for you to impose costs and risks on other people. In the absence of that, the profit-maximizing strategy of firms will be to pollute the environment. We'll be discussing pollution and the environmental problems at length in a couple of lectures, so I won't go on much more here. But just to make one point, whenever there's an effort to increase environmental regulation, corporations say, but this will make us uncompetitive with firms in China or firms in Mexico, right? So the constant complaint is that our environmental regulations make us less competitive. As if that was an argument against regulation, right? That's the argument. What does that really mean? What it means is that in Mexico and China, their firms are allowed to impose costs on other people and to sell their products below the true cost of production as a result. And therefore, we should be allowed to do it as well. Their firms impose harms on people, and therefore our firms should be allowed to do so as well. One might, in the end, conclude we're stuck. We don't have any choice. We're forced to live in a polluted and degraded environment because of competition. That's a possible conclusion, but one shouldn't dignify this by saying it has anything to do with efficiency. It's a violation of efficiency. It means that the markets are acting inefficiently in allocating resources. We're allocating too many resources to the profits of firms when it is the case that firms can make you pay for the costs of disposing of toxic wastes. You pay in the form of increased health costs, for example, because of the illnesses that get generated by environmental pollution. Negative externalities are a central problem of a market economy. Economists often like to treat these as kind of noise, as sort of ripple effects, as small stuff. I don't think that's right. I think negative externalities, if you really think about all the negative side effects of what people do, are a huge problem. And they're a problem for which it's very hard to imagine solutions that don't involve some kind of collective responsibility to impose restrictions on market behavior. There are some kinds of negative externalities which you might not at first glance even think of in this way, but I really think they are. Let me just give you another kind of example. How many of you are from Milwaukee area? Okay, a lot of Milwaukee. So Milwaukee is one of the cities in the U.S. that has suffered what's called deindustrialization over the last 30, 40 years. It used to be a center of manufacturing that produced lots of good jobs for people. It no longer is. Many of those manufacturing firms have moved elsewhere. How should we think about a firm that closes in one place and moves to another in order to make greater profits in the second place? Now, many of the firms that moved out of Milwaukee were profitable when they were in Milwaukee. It's not that they were going bankrupt in Milwaukee and had to move in order to survive. They moved to places where they could make higher profits, but they were still profitable in Milwaukee. How should we think about that? Well, one way of thinking about it is that the decision to close a factory and move it elsewhere creates huge negative externalities for other people who live there, not just for the workers who lose their jobs, but for homeowners. You know, the values of homes goes down in a city where factories move out. It goes down for everybody, not just for the workers who lose their jobs. Now imagine the following. Suppose that the factory in question was owned by the workers who work there. And they were deciding, should we move it to Mexico where we could make higher profits? Or should we keep it here? It's still profitable. Should we keep it here? Well, if they were making that decision, they would say, well, if we move it to Mexico, the housing market is going to collapse here, and I'm going to lose all the value of my home. So that would be part of their calculation. That would no longer be an externality. It would be an internality. It's not a very good word, but it would be a cost that they would directly face. It wouldn't be a cost imposed on somebody else. It'd be a cost imposed on them. So if they did the balance sheet, on balance, we're making a profit here, we can make bigger profits there. But if we move there, housing values go down here. And besides, they may care about their community. That's a separate matter. They would be very unlikely to make the move. What does that mean? It means that when a capitalist firm operating in a market decides where to make its investments, it does not have to worry about the consequences on other people. All that the capitalist firm has to worry about is, where can I have the highest rate of return? That's the only criterion that's needed in deciding where to allocate investments or where to move a factory. And what that means is that the power that's involved in that ability to allocate resources includes the power to impose costs on other people, costs which those people did not choose and for which they were not consulted. That is another example of negative externalities. There are two quite different issues that are really involved in all this. One is that negative externalities seem nasty. It seems really unfair that I can pose costs and risks on other people for my own benefit. So negative externalities violate a common sense notion of fairness. It's just unfair that I have the power to impose all these costs on other people if I'm producing something. But also negative externalities are a form of market inefficiency. What a negative externality means is that that resources are not being efficiently allocated. Efficient allocation only happens if costs are and prices are closely tied together. But if I can displace costs on other people, if I can have zero costs because someone else is paying for it, then my prices don't track the costs, and therefore resources get allocated inefficiently. And this, as we'll see, is one of the big implications of environmental problems. Environmental problems of the magnitude we're facing in the world today are proof that markets are inefficient. They're efficient at producing environmental problems, but they're not efficient in allocating resources. Okay, see you on Tuesday, and we'll finish up this part of the discussion.